All right, well, thank you so much for inviting me here, or at least being here. This is all kind of a surprise for me. I think my mom messaged me when we first arrived and said, hey, would you like to meet some people at the Cascade and other friends of ours? And I said, sure, sure. And then, would you like to talk about the church? You're like, sure, sure. Like, here's a Facebook group, you know, an invite to a meeting. And I suddenly, like, oh, I need to do something. But it's really nice. I mean, I haven't, I don't do this a lot, but it's nice to have a chance to talk. A little bit about me. So I grew up in this area. Obviously, this is my home. My bedroom was up there. I went to Wheaton College. I was an English major at Wheaton. Discovered theology for the first time in some of those courses. Amy and I got married, and we went off to Princeton. I went to Princeton Seminary for my MDiv, and then stayed for my PhD in systematic theology. So we were there for 7 years in Princeton. And it's been, you know, so that journey has been going from a very kind of stable, secure, evangelical kind of context to this wide open education, kind of a fire hose of information. And you know, when I arrived at Princeton, I didn't know anything about even denominations. I didn't know what a Reformed or a Lutheran was. You know, I mean, I was really ignorant about a lot of basic level Christian history and knowledge. So I was exposed, you know, in this rapid fire, kind of full onslaught deluge of information. It was, it was a good learning experience for me. I had to really catch up. So part of what I'll be sharing is kind of my reflections on the church and Christianity, kind of what I've learned through all that process. My own faith evolution is a longer story. We don't need to talk about that now necessarily, but it's kind of woven into some of this. After Princeton, I went and took a job at InterVarsity Press. Some of you know their books. InterVarsity Press is kind of a flagship evangelical publisher. So we lived in the Chicago area for 5 years there. Until last year, or early this year, when I was fired from my InterVarsity Press. So that's been part of my own journey, is my relationship with evangelicalism has kind of gone through this rocky road. And that's also kind of interwoven with some of this. So I appreciate my time there very much. I grew a lot during those years, but it's also given me some perspective. Which will kind of bleed into what I'll talk about. And now I live outside of Kansas City. I work for the University of Kansas at their University Press. It's been kind of a 180 in my career in some ways, but I now edit books in political science and law. So I work with people who are not in my field of theology at all, which is sort of refreshing, but it's also, I also miss these kind of conversations, which I don't have as much anymore. I teach a little bit at the University of Dubuque Theological Seminary in Iowa through online courses in theology. That's kind of how I keep my fingers a bit in that world. And I still write, so I've written a few books. And so, yeah. Before we begin, I do want to pass out a handout. being the teacher that I sometimes am, I make handouts, but you don't need to consult it. It's just a brief outline and some reading list. So you can ignore it. It's just there. I didn't make enough copies for everybody. So if you want one, I can
make more.
I can also give you like a Google Docs link or something if you want later. But anyway.
Is this the syllabus?
I can give that too if you want. But there's
almost a 3
achiever.
I'm a 1
perfectionist. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. So I want to begin with just some simple stuff, but why are we here? Not too much of a surprise. We're here for things that are around us every day in the news. The 81% of white evangelicals who voted for Trump, the 80% of evangelicals who voted for Roy Moore. I mean, these things are constantly around us in the media and the culture. But in addition to that, I have been interested in a lot of the data about the nuns, the religiously unaffiliated. I mean, they're the fastest growing group in the country in terms of religious affiliation or non-affiliation. Like in 1991, only 6% identified as unaffiliated, and now it's 25%. It's Oregon actually has the highest unaffiliated rate in the country. So there's 36% of people in Oregon are unaffiliated or nuns. So that's over a third of the population.
We're
nunnery. Yeah. Only about a quarter of the unaffiliated or the nuns identify as atheists. Most identify as secular, so they might be spiritual in some capacity. But they don't necessarily disbelieve in God. That's a common misunderstanding about that affiliation. Nearly half of LGBTQ Americans are unaffiliated, not surprisingly. The differences are particularly generational. So two-thirds of seniors are white and Christian, while only a quarter of young adults are white and Christian. So young adults are three times more likely than seniors to be nuns. So that whole conversation is interesting to me. I think it's really important in terms of thinking about the church in this country and the future of Christianity. So my introductory kind of remark here is like we're living at the end of the dominance of white Christian America, basically, and many white Christians know it, and they're acting out of fear and concern about this loss of that stable, what they thought was a stable, secure culture that was going to preserve them and their norms and practices and assumptions about the world. And because of the massive inequality of wealth and power in this country, the efforts by some of those white Christians to retain power have been successful, and we see that success in various ways. There are kind of macro level things like the election, as well as Supreme Court cases like the Hobby Lobby case from 2014, the pending case of Masterpiece Cake Shop. Now that I edit law books, and now you get law anecdotes. But the law cases are very interesting. I think they represent kind of a threshold for some of these issues. Obergefell being the one that legalized gay marriage in this country in terms of that was what they saw as kind of a negative thing, but then Hobby Lobby being their positive, retaining some power. If you don't know these cases, we can back up later and talk about them. But they're pretty interesting. But there are also more micro-level situations. I don't remember the World Vision situation a few years ago where they were going to hire gay partner Christians, and then they decided, and then they backtracked when they got a lot of backlash from media about it. InterVarsity's decision last year to fire all employees who believe gay marriage is supportable and theologically supportable. That purge happened a year ago, October 2016. So there are a lot of these situations kind of around us that we see. And of course, there are more micro level things like the person down the road or the pastor of some church or whatever. But there's a lot of fear and a lot of concern about changing cultural dynamics that are affecting us on a regular basis. In my context, being around Wheaton, I don't know if you heard about the Larisha Hawkins situation, who was fired for wearing a hijab in support of Muslims, and that whole situation happened while we were there. It's just these things kind of keep popping up, and it's an impetus, I think, for us to reflect about faith and Christianity in this country. So what I want to do tonight is I want to run through, give you a crash course in how we arrived here, identifying some key dates and figures and ideas, but then also offer some thoughts about the future. We'll get to that. And hopefully we'll have a nice, long, casual conversation where we can just discuss what's on your mind. I am not a trained historian in American Christianity. I'm a specialist in theology and the history of theology. But I have very good friends who are specialists in this area, and we talk a lot. So I'm going to rely on their greater knowledge and pass along their wider wisdom. I've listed some of their books in the bibliography on that handout. But the story I want to tell is a story of a great reversal that took place over the course of a century or more. And this reversal kind of encompasses various factors, theological, economic, political, cultural. And so to understand this, we need to go back to pre-Civil War antebellum Christianity. But before that, I want to do some terminology. So I'm going to use terms like mainline and evangelical, and these terms need to be defined. And they're not always going to be defined perfectly, but I'll give you how I'm going to define it. So mainline refers to those Protestant Christians who belong to one of the denominations that descended from the European Reformation. So we have Anglicans, Episcopalians, Presbyterians, Lutherans, Congregationalists is a broad category, the Methodists. Today we'd also include the UCC, United Church of Christ, the American Baptists, and Disciples of Christ as well. So there's about seven-ish denominations that fall under that umbrella. And I'll refer to them here and there along the way. The word evangelical, not surprised, is a hotly contested term. In our context, in the American context, it refers to those Christians, who, I'm going to use this way, who descended from the Pietist movement in Europe as it migrated to the U.S. and became established through the awakenings and revivals in this country. That's a very broad historical definition. We can talk more about that, but evangelicalism, as I want to define it, is a revival movement, essentially. It's a revival movement, reform movement that aimed to awaken Christianity in this country and make it more heartfelt and more more populist in that sense. Today we are accustomed to identifying or associating mainline Christians with liberal Christianity and evangelicals with conservative Christianity. But before the Civil War, those were exactly the opposite. The mainline churches, where all the wealth and power were concentrated at that time, were very conservative, and they adopted what the theologian historian Jack Rogers called the doctrine of the spirituality of the church, which viewed the church's message as purely spiritual in nature, so that it couldn't speak to social and political matters. And this was adopted largely to support slavery in the country. They didn't want to challenge the slave owners, and so they had a very spiritualized conception of Christianity to maintain that system of power in this country. It was obviously centered in the South, but it pervaded in other areas in the country as well. So if the church is a purely spiritual institution, it doesn't challenge the status quo. So evangelicals in this period were the rebels. They, by contrast, were the kind of the social and theological, resistance movement in that period of time. They were the ones articulating a social and political gospel, actually. During the Second Great Awakening, for instance, evangelists like Charles Finney, who was a very important figure who is really crucial to the Second Great Awakening, he expected that converts, you would come to the bench at the front and have their kind of conversion moment. He expected that the converts would then walk to the back of the church and sign up for the abolitionist movement. That was part and parcel of that conversion. So becoming an evangelical Christian at that period was identical with becoming a political activist in the struggle for racial justice. Evangelicals were also willing to break other theological and social norms. So among the evangelicals were the places where women were first allowed to preach and speak. In public, the early feminist movements originated in those circles. They also questioned traditional doctrines quite freely, actually. Finney was famous for saying that no doctrine should be preached unless it was practical. So that meant he tossed out a lot of doctrines, predestination, a bunch of stuff, unless it actually was practical for the people and actually was socially, meaningful. It was pointless. So. But there were, a lot of doctrines got revised and adjusted. Early Universalists were evangelicals. So evangelicals in this country, and also in UK, were some of the first Universalists in this country. They also challenged the doctrine of the Trinity, too, because they didn't find it in the Bible. They were very strong about biblical authority, but they were willing to question doctrine. So the current Unitarian Universalists came out of the evangelical movement in the 19th century. So all this stuff it's migrated way beyond that, but that it all originated among the evangelicals. Western New York in particular was the kind of epicenter for a lot of these movements. It's an area you may have heard of. It's called the Burned Over District. It was called that by Finney because it was a place that had been so heavily evangelized that there was no more fuel to burn. But this was a home, that was the home for social radicals at the time. The early feminist Elizabeth Cady Stanton lived there and formed the Seneca Halls Convention for Suffrage. It was the birthplace of Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah's Witnesses, and early spiritualism, so seances. It all started there. Western New York, so that area. All of those religious movements began there because there was a freedom to break away from traditional doctrines and start new religious movements. So that's where Joseph Smith left and came over from Western New York to Utah. It was also the source of converts to kind of utopian socialism in the tradition of Charles Fourier. It was the home of the Oneida Society, which was like this utopian group with had a group marriage and open, everything was shared property and everything. it later became the home of the social gospel movement later on, the Rauschenbusch. So you know, all the stuff kind of originated right there, and it was an evangelical hotbed. For more about some of this stuff, the Ted Smith book, The New Measures, is all about Finney and kind of his influence on these things. And then Donald Dayton's book, Discovering Evangelical Heritage, is quite good. He kind of identifies some of these radical early evangelical reformers. So if you want to read more about it, that's where I would go. So the point basically here is that antebellum Christianity, antebellum evangelicalism, was a radical form of Christianity that openly questioned standard doctrinal, moral, cultural, and political norms. It was an early resistance movement. Now, obviously all that changed. So I'm going to review kind of some of the touchstones about how it went from there to today. Obviously this is a much more complex history than I'm going to be able to describe, but we'll power through and we can nuance it later. But the period after the Civil War is a really interesting period. I mean, that Reconstruction era, a lot is going on. Can't talk about all the politics that were happening, but one of the things that happened in that period was the rise of apocalyptic eschatology, which took hold in about the 1860s, 1870s. You might know it as dispensationalism. That was one version of apocalyptic eschatology that was very popular at the time. I highly recommend Matthew Avery Sutton's book, American Apocalypse, which basically charts the influence of eschatology as that influences all of modern evangelicalism.
Can
and kind
you
of
eschatology?
Yes, sorry. Eschatology is the doctrine of the end or the last things, what's going to happen at the end of the world, end of history. So typically the second coming of Christ, the last judgment, there's different aspects to it, but whatever the end involves, and that's eschatology. By apocalyptic, I mean versions of eschatology that view that end as being not just imminent, perhaps, although it's often imminent, very soon, but also something we can know and describe, that we can map out what's going to happen. X, Y, Z is going to occur in these future years. So it tended to, this wasn't the birthplace of apocalyptic eschatology. That goes back to ancient Judaism way back thousands of years ago, but it was a modern form of it. And it really took hold in the U.S. in that period, post-Civil War period, and it just changed everything in terms of how people viewed their faith and how they viewed society.
Did it take more in the South, or was it
popular? All over the place, everywhere. Yeah. So Wheaton College, for example, the founder of Wheaton College was Jonathan Blanchard. He was a disciple of Charles Finney, very radical abolitionist. His son, Charles, became the second president, and he was a disciple of the dispensational leader, John Nelson Darby, and changed the school basically overnight into a dispensationalist stronghold. So it was this radical kind of progressive evangelical bastion, and then with his son, it became this incredibly reactionary conservative place. That's all because of the differing influences, Finney versus Darby, basically. We'll get to more of that, but yeah. And that was in the North. That's in Illinois, so this is really everywhere. But yeah, Sutton's book traces all of that from New York down to L.A., kind of the influence of this eschatology. So, And part of what it did was it led evangelicals to abandon the activism that they had before. You know, if the world's imminently going to end, what's the point of trying to reform our social structures and our political life? We need to just get people saved, right? So, like, the point of revivals became about rescuing people from divine judgment and hellfire, not about signing them up for social reform movements. So evangelical eschatology, it just instigated a massive shift. So instead of seeing the church as this vanguard of social transformation, the church became a fortress to protect the chosen remnant in the coming tribulation. So today, evangelicals are known especially for having a persecution complex. We're going to be, you know, they always see themselves under attack by this godless world, which is from this moment. That idea came into being in this era. Because before that, they viewed the world as a place that needed to transform and actually work to make better. But then it became this place that was that they were being attacked by this satanic, you know, influence that they had to be rescued from, and they were going to be rescued from shortly. So that's a big piece. I mean, there's a lot more to say about that, but that's a huge part. The next thing that I want to talk about is Heath Carter's book, Union Made. And what he does in this book is he shows that part of what made the evangelical movement so effective was that they represented, in the early years, the plight of the working people. Like, Finney wasn't this grandiose preacher. He was just one of the people, one of the masses of relatively impoverished people preaching a simple message. They weren't part of the political and economic elite. And that was in contrast to the mainline churches, which were super wealthy, the aristocracy, basically. But after the Civil War, pastors at that period began to see a huge increase in their pay due to the increased size of their churches and the patronage of leading figures in the cities, especially places like Chicago. So their churches became very ornate, increasingly expensive, bigger buildings, serving as a kind of a sign of their social prestige and power. And the result was that when social conflicts arose in some of the cities, especially in Chicago, the pastors began to side with the employers and owners of the businesses and corporations over against the laborers. So the church leaders became concerned about having a respectable Christianity, a very, you know, it would look good to society. And that alienated a lot of the working class people, which spawned these reactions against it, which Heath Carter documents in his book. The next book I want to talk about is Timothy Glegg, his Guaranteed Pure. So he continues this story. This is a history of Dwight L. Moody and the Moody Bible Institute. Again, another Chicago institution, a very important institution for evangelical history in this country. What Glegg documents is how Moody and his right-hand man, Reuben Torrey, developed a radically individualistic spirituality that wouldn't challenge the unjust social policies of the business leaders whose money and power they were courting. So again, you can kind of see here already, this is the exact mirror image of what the mainline churches were doing in the antebellum period. Now they're adopting this kind of very spiritualized doctrine of the church, and so... whereas antebellum leaders like Finney wanted to shake up the social order, Torrey and Moody wanted to gain a seat at the table of power, basically. So Moody especially pioneered wearing a business suit when he preached. He was one of the first people who did that. Instead of wearing a collar or something, you wear a business suit to attract the business leaders, the corporate leaders. Torrey went on to help edit and write The Fundamentals, which launched the Fundamentalist movement later on. That kind of was a 12-volume work that's kind of systematized modern evangelicalism. And it's a very interesting work. There are the usual things you might see about, you know, atonement or Christ or whatever. But there are many articles in there in opposition to, say, evolution, not surprisingly. Historical study of the Bible was rejected in there. And they had even a couple articles on socialism, as we have to, you know, reject socialism. So the essays kind of give this picture of Christianity being on the side of capital money, on the side of, you know, rejecting kind of the latest science and the latest social research. It's the kind of seeds of the anti-intellectualism of modern evangelicalism were kind of planted in that period by Torrey and Moody.
What period?
So this is, so 1880s to 1900s. Yeah, yeah. The actual fundamentals were published in 1910, but they were, it's a multi-volume work, and it kind of came out bits and pieces throughout the period. The final book I'll talk about is Kevin Cruz's book, One Nation Under God. And that book looks at the way evangelicalism contributed to this alliance between Christianity, capitalism, and nationalism. The nation becomes important here. And that synthesis took hold, especially after World War II. So it's a little later in history. And that were, there are numerous reasons for that. Part of it is the post-war period saw, with the GI Bill, the rise of kind of middle-class consumerism and evangelical kind of nationalism at the same time. You had, that's the period, in 1954 is when you have One Nation Under God put into the Pledge of Allegiance. And you have, 1956 was when In God We Trust is put on the coins. So this kind of connection between God and nation is kind of solidified right there in the mid-20th century. but you also, in that same period, that same decade of the 50s, you also have the start of Christianity Today, Fuller Seminary, the National Association of Evangelicals, all those major evangelical institutions that are now, you know, dominant forces were all started right then, that post-war period. And so you have this kind of synthesis of all these factors kind of coming together. There are issues also of race, I mean, to get into, but we don't have all day. So, but I would recommend, so a lot of this I am borrowing slash stealing from my good, very good friend, Travis McMacken, his book, Our God Loves Justice, which just came out a couple months ago, and I highly recommend it. He and I are kind of partners in crime in terms of our theological work, and it's a really good book, but he goes through all the stuff. I'll just briefly kind of run through the rest of the story. A lot of this you might have heard of or know about because it's more recent history, but mid-20th century, 50s and 60s, a lot of the conservative evangelical leaders were initially mobilized against the civil rights movement, arguing that racial problems were a matter of the heart and not something that a government could fix. That was in that same period. In the 50s and 60s is when you have the young earth creationist movement begin. That idea was created, kind of conceived in the late 50s, early 60s. In 1968 and 72, the Southern Strategy was put into place by Barry Goldwater and Richard Nixon, which led to an alignment of the Republican Party with conservative white America. So prior to the Southern Strategy, the Republican Party was the party of the more radical, racial justice party, and the Democrats were the more, Southern party. And those were reversed in the late 60s and early 70s. In the 70s also is when the Battle for the Bible took place. Harold Lindzell was the editor of Christianity Today and felt like there was an attack on inerrancy of the Bible. And he wrote a book called The Battle for the Bible, which single-handedly basically launched our current anxiety about the inerrancy of the Bible and infallibility. So those terms, if those aren't familiar with those terms, basically means the Bible has no errors, well, there's other things lumped into those terms, but basically we don't need to study it in its history because it's just right there on the page, and we don't have to think too much about it. It's perfectly correct, self-evidently correct. And then 1980 is when evangelical leaders connected this alignment with evangelicalism in support of Ronald Reagan. So that happened there. Since you had Carter before that, and anyway, it's complicated history there. I recommend other books you can read about some of this stuff. Randall Balmer's book is really good, Thy Kingdom Come. I should have put that on the list, but he's really good on the history of that period in the 80s. Okay, so I'm sorry that took too long, but that's a brief, mostly brief history of how we got from there to here. So what I'm going to do now is just kind of identify what I think are some of the key problems and what are the maybe some possible solutions or responses to this. So the first one I want to identify is what I would call Christian libertarianism. Libertarianism is a philosophy of political philosophy that basically identifies the individual as this kind of soul, completely free agent that's not attached to anything or anyone else. And that the individual is what's key. The individual freedom and liberty is the most important thing. We have to protect that at all costs. It's a very negative kind of freedom. It's a freedom from others, not a freedom for others. That's a key difference. The libertarianism is a very negative freedom from posture. And so, like, I am defined by my independence from you, not my dependence upon you or for you or responsibility for you. And that creates a culture that denies institutional and structural injustice and sin, and also opposes systemic structural reforms. Because libertarian philosophy basically doesn't think that there are such things as structures and systems. There are just individual monads, basically, who are personally responsible for their own actions and nobody else's, and nobody else's consequences, right, other than their own. This idea isn't unique to Christianity, of course, but it has a foothold in American society and culture. I mean, I'm sure it's not surprising. You've probably seen people who have this idea and talk about this way of thinking. But it lends itself to a very capitalistic, consumeristic society that caters to individual wealth and power, because those things aren't challenged, or they don't. If a person can gain whatever they can gain, then that's theirs, and they aren't responsible for anyone else. And there's a history about how that kind of arose in this country, which goes back to the larger American political thought kind of question. But it's had its foothold in, I think, evangelicalism currently. A bigger issue is the crisis of authority question. So there's a lot I could say about the crisis of authority. But what I mean by this is there are different ways in which there's a crisis of authority. I'll give you a couple big ones. The original one is the Reformation. The Reformation basically said the Catholic Church isn't the sole authority and arbiter and decider of what's true and godly and authoritative. So there was a crisis that the Reformation brought into play, which opened up old assumptions to scrutiny and critique and ongoing discussion. So you couldn't trust the old church authorities, and you could trust now new authorities, whether it was scientific or political or theological. Now, evangelicalism arose within that initial crisis of authority, but then as it migrated to the U.S., as I've talked about, there's another crisis that it kind of spawned or kind of contributed to. The way I want to describe this is, like, so evangelicalism initially was this reform movement, right? It was reforming against kind of old orthodoxies and old ways of doing things, whether it was the old theologies of the mainline church that they wanted to reject, or social practices that they wanted to reject, like slavery. But as evangelicalism kind of took hold in this country, it became only a purifying reform movement. There was this purifying drive, reforming whatever needed to be reformed, but there wasn't any content to it, right? Evangelicalism doesn't have a doctrine or tradition. There's no authority there that's rooted in any sort of textual or theological tradition, a body of thought. It's just this impulse to reform and purify whatever the church is at that time. So initially that was great, because the old church was very conservative and very problematic morally. So the reform movement was progressive. But then later on, as new ideas came into play, the reform movement the machine kept going, and reformed it in very conservative and authoritarian directions. So, so there's the crisis of authority here within evangelicalism is that it doesn't. There's nothing of substance to define what it means to be evangelical, and we kind of all know this from seeing all the constant debates about who's the authentic evangelical, who's a true evangelical. You know, is it this doctrine or is it, you know, that practice? And no one can disagree. And no one can agree. There's as many versions of evangelicalism as there are people who claim to be evangelical. That's partly because there's this crisis of authority within evangelicalism historically. It doesn't have doesn't have a magisterium like the Catholic Church does to say, this is what you believe, this is how you live. And it doesn't have the traditions of mainline churches, which have this kind of history in place. It's just a constantly reforming, revivaling, you know, revivaling, make that a word up, constantly changing, reforming movement. And so there's nothing there that's determining the direction of those reforms and those purifications. It's just this impulse to diverge. So that's why you have the kind of constant splitting of churches and constant diversifying of what it means to be evangelical, whether it's disagreeing over a potluck or disagreeing over some doctrine. It's, you know, there's this constant search for the purest, best form of evangelicalism. So. Hi. Hi. Get a drink. So I'll carry on, but you can kind of pretend that you'll just. But I'm talking about the crisis of authority in evangelicalism and kind of how we got to this point. The point basically being there's no tradition or structure upon which a positive evangelical community rooted in justice can form. That was always simply a accident of history at that time. It wasn't a part of its structure. So the early reforms of Finney in that period weren't something essential to evangelicalism. It just happened to be that the evangelicals who were active at that time happened to be reacting against an unjust social order. But as that changed later on, it went off in other directions. The point being, evangelicalism is able to be co-opted and directed by the winds of culture. That's basically what happens. And it doesn't have a foundation or a grounding. And this is not a bug in the system, but it's actually part of its DNA to be led in those various directions. And the 20th and 21st centuries have seen the rise of this crisis of authority to dangerous levels, I think we can all agree. So evangelicalism has been defined in the most kind of broad, superficial terms. So the NAE, the National Association of Evangelicals, just has two doctrines, Trinity and inerrancy, as its defining characteristics of evangelicalism. And their inerrancy is basically a shibboleth. It doesn't mean people actually know anything about the Bible. You just need to affirm that it's inerrant. And the problem with inerrancy in this way is that the Bible is a very plastic text, meaning that it can be used to support almost anything. So ultimately, inerrancy is a belief in the authority of whatever evangelical leaders say about the Bible. And this has made evangelicalism deeply authoritarian in nature. It has no tradition or theology or practice or confession that people can engage and debate and analyze. It is simply a belief in its own unimpeachable authority. And this makes it possible for evangelicalism to support any leader or movement, regardless of what that leader or movement stands for, so long as that leader or movement is deemed to be within the evangelical inner circle of authority. So there are no criteria apart from the arbitrary decision by white male leaders, predominantly the power brokers, to make something authentically evangelical. And the end result of this is that we have Trump is accepted as evangelical. That's essentially what happens.
When did that school of thought begin?
It goes back a long ways. This is actually part of its DNA back to the Finney. I mean, this is the problem with Finney. I mean, Finney was great in many ways, but it was, like, for him, I mean, evangelicalism didn't have a substance beyond whatever was practical at that moment. So it was great at that point in time, because what was practical at that moment was let's tear down slavery and be abolitionists, you know. But it was easily co-opted a generation later and turned in the opposite direction. So that's the problem. It was, and there wasn't much reflection on this. There wasn't, and partly they were all they were all rebels against an order. It was all a negative rejection of something else. So they were rejecting this mainline social institution, but they didn't have a positive alternative. It was just they were saying no to slaveholding mainline churches. But then it was really easy, once you have that kind of negative posture, if there's something positive to support it, to go in other directions. So, yeah. That's Ted Smith, his book on Finney, The New Measures, on that list. What he does in that book, it's really brilliant, is he looks at six different facets of Finney's ministry and identifies these really positive elements, but then these deeply problematic aspects to each one of those. And what he does in each one is he has this crucifixion and resurrection of each one of those motifs and ideas of Finney. So saying we can't bring back Finney because it's deeply problematic, but we can take an element of his thinking and kind of resurrect a new form of it. But the original form led to some serious problems. So along with that, the evangelical crisis of authority, it leads to a very binary approach to Christian identity. You either accept biblical authority or you don't. You either are in the inner circle or you are not. You either are saved or you're not. You either share a certain political value or you don't. You support America or you don't. You know, go on and so on and so forth. Once the authority becomes the point, you know, once it's all about whether or not you are accepting of their authoritarian structure, that's what it comes down to. And when you combine that with the libertarianism, you get this issue where evangelicalism is whatever I want it to be for my own personal well-being and growth. And the final thing I want to talk about is the culture of fear. This is all part of the same package. But if anything defines evangelicalism today, it's probably fear. I think you can kind of identify three aspects to it. There's a theology of fear, hell, divine judgment, guilt, all this. I think the Gospel Coalition just released their five biggest problems in society today, and the number one was sin. You know, it's like, of course, you know, it's always this, it's always sin, it's always guilt, it's always, you know, something like that. Number four on the list was poorly formed Christians. They weren't properly educated by their theology, you know. Anyway, so it's a theology of fear. there's also practices of fear. Certain kinds of evangelism are this kind of this compulsive need to kind of save your friend, or else they're going to die and go to hell. The kind of apologetics maneuver, we're always trying to defend the faith and prove that God exists and all the rest. So these are kind of the practices of fear that we engage in. And then there's a politics of fear, of course, the culture war, the persecution complex. I have a friend who works at Arizona State University in the religion department there, and he's working on a big project on the thinking behind this, the idea of this global war on Christians that you kind of hear about a lot in kind of conservative media. And what's really interesting about his work is that, you know, the people who bring out this narrative that there's this global war on Christianity, they'll cite numbers of, you know, so-called martyrs. You know, anytime a person who might identify as Christian is killed, they'll claim that as one of their own, one of their soldiers who has been, you know, killed. But those same people, they reject as actually authentically Christian because they're not evangelicals. They're often, you know, Armenian Orthodox or something like that, you know. So there's this real kind of bait and switch there where they're always claiming whatever is supports their politics, but then denying them when it suits them other ways. Anyway, there's a whole ideology there of this global war. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Precisely. So they're only they become an object to them. They're usable as a statistic, right? And then that's all they are. So yeah, the theology of practices and politics of fear. And the fear binds together what the previous two things, the libertarianism and the authority crisis. So, you know, Christian libertarianism is constantly in fear of having one's personal liberty threatened by others. And the crisis of authority is constantly in fear of others challenging its authority. Since its claim to authority, arbitrary authority, is all that holds it together. So once somebody puts a chink in that armor, whether it's attack on biblical inerrancy, then that becomes an attack on the whole thing, right? That's why the battle for the Bible was so potent at the time was, you can't let go of one thing, you know? So I remember, you know, the arguments about creation evolution, you know, a lot of the literature on that, it was about if you don't accept Genesis 1 and 2 as literal, then we can't have Jesus as our savior. Like, that was the argument. That was the slippery slope, right? If you let go of this, everything falls, right? And the same argument is made about, you know, gay marriage debates. You know, if you have the one verse in Romans 1, you know, if that verse doesn't hold true, then everything else goes, right? And that's part of this fear. If we let go of something, then the whole thing is gone, because the authority has to hold together as a totality, or it's non-existent. So I want to briefly present kind of alternatives to each one of these. So what might need to change? I think we need to develop a Christian communitarianism. This is a developing a communal, social, structural approach to life and identity. Our problems are systemic, and they require systemic solutions. And that's true both in the church, but also in society at large. You know, we need to think, we need to view ourselves as connected to other people, and understand our life as being bound up with other people's lives. And we need to think about that in a really full-scale sense. Part two, decolonizing authority. So the solution to the crisis of authority is not to settle for a purely formal authoritarian power that regulates who's in and who's out. Like, we need to have norms. We need to have principles that govern our belief and practice. But we cannot simply repristinate and bring back the old doctrines and practices and norms. We have to think about these things in a new way. And I want to suggest one of the ways we can do that is to decolonize our view of authority. By this, I mean, we need to recognize the way in which our old authority structures have been tied to imperial and colonial powers in the past, whether that's the power of nations or the power of churches that have supported themselves by marginalizing and oppressing others. And rather than rejecting authority altogether, I think we need to subject our understanding of authority to the critique of those who have been marginalized and oppressed in the past, and listening to them and allowing our views of authority and practices and norms to be fruitfully engaged and critiqued by that. So an initial step to do this, I would suggest, is to really engage in careful reflection on what scholars would call hermeneutics. So hermeneutics is a fancy term for interpretation or understanding. Hermeneutics is a study of how we come to understand something, whether it's a text or a person. And it's traditionally and frequently avoided by evangelicals because it recognizes in principle that understanding isn't self-evident. Understanding is complex and it's ambiguous. And so that's a problem for inerrancy, because inerrancy requires that understanding should be immediate and self-evident. It doesn't require interpretation. So an area of work that I've done a lot of stuff is intercultural hermeneutics. So intercultural hermeneutics is a way of thinking about understanding in relationship to kind of cultural pluralism, differences of cultures, how a pluralistic cultural society affects how we think and know others and other and texts as well. That's a longer conversation. You can read my books if you want. And lastly, I'll preach a bit, but we need to deconstruct fear and reconstruct love. people like to refer to the First John verse, you know, there's no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. But it's true. I think we need to kind of claim that and think about what that would mean. So briefly, I'll suggest think about the Pauline triad of faith, hope, and love. So a theology of faith, not blind belief, but a fidelity to the God that stands with the marginalized of the world. Practices of hope, not an empty optimism, but a vision for seeing new possibilities and working towards them. And a politics of love, not a sentimental fad, but a commitment to the well-being of our neighbors. So that's all I have. I guess we'll just hopefully have a time of conversation and Q&A. So I hope that wasn't too long. But so what are your all thoughts? For those of you who came in late, there's a handout here, which we can make a copy of it for you if you want. Just a brief outline and some further reading, if you so choose. So I was presumptuous enough to include my own book on there, but sorry.
Do you see that same cycle that we've seen with the evangelical movement, where at first it was a part of kind of moving society forward, right?
Yeah.
And then it became a part of that same cog.
Yep, right.
Is that true of Christianity throughout its history, or is that kind of more... Because I do see, you know, the Reformation has a lot to do with the, you know, Catholicism means unity. The point was to bring the church together.
Yeah.
But then it became kind of its own institution to itself. So is that true?
Yeah. So I'll repeat the question for those who are here listening to this. But so is the cycle of reform and then kind of becoming part of the machine a cycle that's repeated itself throughout history in Christianity? And the answer is yes. I mean, that's definitely the case. I mean, there is an evangelical historian who I worked with when I was at IVP, Ken Stewart, who just published a book that I was working on before I got terminated. Which is basically makes that argument that evangelicalism, he wants to define evangelicalism as a perennial reform movement throughout the history of Christianity, not just post-Reformation. It's just evangelical just means that reform impulse that happens throughout Christian history. And I think that's probably fair. I think that's some truth to that. We definitely see reform movements throughout the history of the church. I mean, there's a whole lot of them. I mean, that's whether the medieval mystics were an example of this, early desert fathers were an example of that. Even just prior to the Reformation, you know, you have John Huss, and you have some of those folks. I mean, that's an ongoing thing. They didn't all necessarily become part of the machine of the church necessarily. Some of them just fizzled out or were killed. There were various ways in which those things were snuffed out or lost. So it's complex. Some of them went off and, formed heretical sects, heretical according to the Orthodox power brokers of the church. Heresy. So heresy is, in official church doctrine, orthodoxy refers to whatever is officially mandated by the church authorities as correct teaching. So that's usually the creeds and the confessions of a church. Heresy is technically whatever is in disagreement with those creeds. So those creeds, like the Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed, these early texts were written in response to what they viewed as heretical or non-orthodox movements. And so each one of those lines of those early creeds and confessions is a response to some heresy, basically, what they viewed as a heresy. And so some of those movements went off to do other things. So, for example, some of the Eastern Orthodox churches are churches that don't accept the official Catholic teaching on Christ as being both divine and human. So the Coptic Orthodox, for example, is an example of this. They're one of the early church councils in 450, year 450, in Chalcedon, determined that Christ is divine and human in one person, and they had a different interpretation of that, and they were deemed heretical, and they went off and did their own thing. So they have their own church movement, which still exists today over in Egypt, but they aren't considered Orthodox by the Catholic Church, basically. And there's a lot of that. Protestants are deemed heretical also by the Catholic Church. So, I mean, in some ways, you know, we're all descendants of heretical movements. What counts as heretical is always a very contested political conversation. You know, who determines what's orthodox and what's heretical? You know, who's the deciding authority figure? And the Catholic Church has a magisterium, a body of people who are authorized to make that call for their community. And then, of course, people like Martin Luther just disagreed, you know, and say, no, we're not heretical. We're following, you know, the same faith. And so these debates are always kind of going throughout the church history. But there are many kind of spin-off movements of Christianity that, had different views about some of these issues. So... not all of them survived. You know, a lot of them failed. That's how it, you know. Yes?
Yeah. I found what you said to be really fascinating, and just I'm a person who pays attention to patterns and stuff, and as I overheard you talking about the history and like how we got to where we are, it made me think not of just the history of church, but this is kind of a human pattern to just like deconstruct, reconstruct, stay there,
yeah,
and then deconstruct, reconstruct, and stay there. And yep, you know, as you were talking, I'm a therapist in training, and I was like, man, the capital C church needs therapy. Because
yeah,
because we're, what a therapist does is like you look at these patterns and you interrupt those patterns in a way that creates new, more holistic patterns. And that's what we need to do. We need to move away from this pattern of, okay, what do we have wrong? How do we fix that and get to the right thing and then stay there?
Yep.
Because inevitably we're going to deconstruct it again, and it's just this cycle that keeps going. So I like these, what needs to change, cause especially the decolonizing authority, looking at where is our authority coming from, and then like,
yeah, I mean, I have a friend who I can give you the book reference later, but he's a does psychoanalysis work and basically does he psychoanalyzes the church and Christianity in a couple of his books. And that's basically what he does, is subject the church to therapy in his book, which is, it's a fascinating work. It's really good. But yeah, I can give you that information, whoever wants that. But yeah, I think that's those cycles certainly do repeat themselves for sure. Yeah.
Was wondering how effective are your conversations with evangelicals? Like when the global war on Christianity gets brought up,
yeah,
how do you respond to that? Is there any way to kind of swing the conversation away from that? Like how do you approach those kinds of conversations?
So the question is, how do I approach conversations with evangelicals on some of these topics and how successful I am? I would say the fact that I am where I am now indicates I haven't been too successful with some of that. I've had great success talking to younger evangelicals about these questions. I mean, I think generationally that's a huge difference. And I think there's a number of, you know, reasons for some of that. Partly that's just millennial anxiety about the world in general, and realizing that the old structures no longer work. Whether that's can't rely on some sort of retirement, or you know, whatever it might be, a job or school isn't going to work out. You know, so and religion is part of that, right? It's just all kind of mixed up with this sense that the way things have been aren't working and they're broken. You know, and so I think younger evangelicals recognize that. A lot of them do. Some of them are trying really hard to keep them working, you know, and make sure that they can sustain themselves in the future. But it does depend on who I'm talking to. I think I've had to do, when I was at university, I worked a lot with Southern Baptists, you know, circles, because some of our authors were Southern Baptists, and I would go down there, and that's a completely different world, because they don't feel any of that anxiety, or they don't feel a lot of the anxiety, because they have an ecosystem that is completely working for them, and it's self-perpetuating, because they grow up in these churches, they go to their Southern Baptist universities, they go out to the Southern Baptist seminaries, they go work in those churches that are still thriving, and they come back, and they just feed the cycle. So their ecosystem is intact, and it wasn't threatened by the economic downturn or anything else. You know, they just have their own culture that just is its own thing, and so you know, they hire their own. They just keep hiring their own people. Now at some point that's unsustainable just with growth, but they don't feel a lot of those concerns, and so that manifests itself in the way in which their politics remain kind of tied to the social order, the status quo. But outside of that bubble, I would say the younger evangelicals are pretty open to tearing down some of the old systems. But I've largely given up trying to save evangelicalism, to be honest. I think I used to have this vision that I was going to do that. I can say this now that I'm no longer there, but I took the job at university so I could have an influence on the inside and kind of change. And I think I did, in some ways. I did have an influence on the inside. You know, I would reject certain books that I think were toxic and brought in new authors and new voices that were healthier. And I'm happy about that work, but ultimately, several of those authors also were fired from their institutions, you know? So, you know, I might have been able to support some of that work and bring them into conversation with evangelicals, but the machine that kind of regulates who's in and who's out is impervious to some of that stuff. And so I've kind of largely given up on trying to do that. I think I used to say we need to reform and save evangelicalism, and now I think it just needs to die, to be honest.
That's fair.
So.
Can I answer that a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
A little bit more personal background about David and I and kind of where we've ended up, because we did kind of want to be the bridge in some sense. And I also ended up working at university for several years. And we now affiliate or identify as Episcopalian. I actually work at a United Church of Christ church, so we don't even go to the same church right now. But I kind of agree with this idea of like having those conversations and trying to convince people through talking isn't working. And so I found I kind of have also given up in a sense of wanting to save anything, and realize that all I can do is just be me more and like live into the theology of faith and you know, those practices of love, and hope that speaks to people. And I think in a lot of ways that it has. That's where we've been more successful, is in, you know, like with our families, you know, just having them witness our actions and then ask questions, and then having the conversations that way feels much more meaningful and purposeful, and ends up in better places than just trying to convince people. Because I think we all know, especially in this climate, that having debates and like trying to persuade people through talk and facts and those kinds of things isn't working.
There's another thing too, also, and that is, I'm really much more conscious of the need to oppose the white male savior complex, which is just pervasive in progressive Christianity circles. Honestly, at this point, I need to not be the savior of anything. There are people out there who are doing that work, whose voices need to be lifted up, who we just need to listen to. They're already doing it. I think that's one of the biggest problems I have with evangelical, you know, progressive evangelical churches coming to the inner city and saying we're going to heal the racial divides in our cities. There are already Black and Asian churches, you know, doing that, Latino churches doing that work, you know, and they need to be empowered and supported.
Or might not be churches,
right? Or whatever. Or yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's just, I think that's a white Christian problem. Especially, but also a male problem too. So.
So then, what are some of the biggest actions or things that you do that seem to get through to people's interest in asking you questions that have been effective? Like, what are those major things?
One of them was leaving the evangelical church and becoming a part of a mainline denomination. That was kind of a big conversation piece. Both David and I have came out of a tradition where anybody who wasn't evangelical was sort of a question mark, like, are you really a Christian? I mean, so that was a big step for us, and that was a long time, long process, several years. When we were at the last church that we were a part of, I did like community organizing work, so just questions about like, well, what is that, you know? And then just, you know, we're no longer afraid to voice our opinions about things, whether we're not really necessarily wanting to convince people to change their minds, but just saying like, here's where I stand on this issue and you can take it or leave it. But it does at least open the door for somebody to say, oh, you're the kind of person who is safe to ask those questions to, like, because I know where you came from and I know where you are now. And that's been a huge thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm in a slight advantage insofar as I've published stuff that people have read, and so they know, oh, you're a person who can, I can talk to you about some of these questions. But I think being visible in spaces of protest also, being active. I mean, I think, I went to the protest for Lucia Hawkins at Wheaton College, stood with the students there who were, raising their voices about that, and there were news cameras around, that kind of thing. Just like being visible, just being a visible presence, bodily, putting your bodies in those places. But social media has also been it's done a lot of stuff. I do a lot of work on Twitter. So if those of you follow me on Twitter, a lot of the stuff you might have seen in some form on Twitter. That's kind of where I've done a lot of my kind of post-evangelical activism. I have the privilege of having a large enough platform on Twitter where a lot of people are reading it. So, but that kind of generates conversation often. Alexander knows. I think the most important factor for change is just personal relationships and friendships, getting to know people on a personal level. That's certainly been the most impactful, I think, in terms of changing views on LGBT Christians, especially. It's just getting to know somebody from that community and listening to their stories. So wherever that happens, we've become pretty active in what's called an ex-evangelical community on Facebook. There's an ex-evangelical podcast that a friend of mine runs, and they have a big Facebook group that Amy is a moderator of, which is kind of a safe haven for a lot of those folks, so a place for them to feel free to dialogue and unites people from around the world who are talking about that stuff. So, yeah.
So in that, how do you find a core to the work that's done so that it's not a new evangelicalism, right?
Yeah.
Opposed to this current iteration of evangelicalism, but it's right for future.
Yeah, exactly. So, what's the positive? What's the positive substance, right? That's the million-dollar question. Like, what's the actual meat of the gospel, right? And I think, that's partly what I tried to do in my book. My most recent book was to sketch out what I think that norm or principle is. But I'm hesitant to say this is the one norm or single principle or only substance that is viable or valid. I think there are multiple ones that we can, there's a diversity, I think, internal to Christianity that we can affirm and support. That being said, I think, there are certain things that I would want to lift up. Part of what I talked about here, kind of a faith, hope, and love is going to be central to all that. I think there's going to be, but how do we characterize those aspects is really important, right? I think it needs to be a faith that recognizes a God who's not a faith that denies the idolatry of God, that opposes idolatry, that opposes the attempt to co-opt God as part of our culture or political system, right? That recognizes God's otherness. I think that's a crucial part of it, but that in itself isn't sufficient. We have to tie that along with a conception of love that is bound up with our neighbor and socially oriented and connected to the good of the other. I think that's a kind of nuts and bolts of how I want to flesh some of that stuff out. In my book, I characterize it as this experience of being displaced. That's how I define faith. In my book, is the experience of being moved outside of ourselves towards others. That part of what I think genuine Christian faith is about is being moved out of our egos and moved towards the other in a loving fidelity towards with others. And so I kind of flesh that out theologically and kind of sketch that what that would look like, but. There's more to say about that, but that's part of what I would hope the positive substance would be for me. Yeah.
think that the mainline, now that mainlines are a part of the movement, moving society forward, a lot of mainlines are taking on that very blatantly.
Yeah.
Do you think that they are doing it more in a healthier way than maybe the original evangelical did with, you know, with ending slavery?
Yep. Yeah. I think so. I, the reason for that is the advantage that the mainline churches have is that they do have a very kind of solid tradition to build upon. There's a robust body of traditions and practices and doctrines that they can, that ground their practice. It's not simply an anomaly based on whatever is faddish at the moment. There's a deep-rooted tradition there of peace activism and engagement with the social welfare, you know, of others and civil rights and the rest. So I mean, would you agree? I mean,
basically what you said.
I think that's probably, I think so. It's, that doesn't necessarily mean it's the ideal or the only version, certainly. I mean, there are, you know, every community has its issues, but there's certainly, there's a, kind of, how to describe it, like a solidity to it. Like there's something there that it's not, like the way it acts in public is consonant with its faith and its traditions. It corresponds and it makes sense. It's not simply, and if it were to replicate another location, it would do the same thing. You know, it would find its own way of doing that same thing in that place, right? It wouldn't be I think you've all experienced this. A lot of the kind of non-denominational evangelical churches tend to be governed by whoever is in power, whoever the pastor is that church, right? It's entirely dependent on who you have in leadership at any given time. It's just true, you know. And I, for better or for worse, sometimes you have great leaders like Kurt, you know, Kurt. You can have great people doing great things at those churches, but the moment that person leaves, somebody else can come in and can be a completely different place. And this pattern is just pervasive in American evangelicalism, where it doesn't happen at all in the mainline churches. For example, even Methodist churches, pastors in that church are often required to move from church to church every 3 or 4 years, right? And that's intentional on their part to prevent that from happening, right? To make sure that those churches are not rooted in whoever is their pastor at that given time, but is that there's a body of faith and doctrine and practice that's there that governs who they are and defines their identity and their life and in the faith. The Episcopal Church, what I like about the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Communion, it's not defined by any doctrine at all, really. I mean, they have 39 articles, but they're not official. You don't have to subscribe to them. What governs them is entirely this liturgy, this liturgical life. And that liturgy is deeply theological. There's a lot of theology in that liturgy, but it's the practice of that liturgy. You don't have to subscribe to certain doctrines. You know, you could be an atheist, and that's perfectly fine. What matters is, are you willing to work alongside us in this community for the well-being of our neighbors? That's what matters. You know, are you going to share in the life of our community? It's participation, not belief, that matters. That's the crucial thing. I think, and that's true for a lot of the mainline churches, that it's, are you going to partner with us in this work? It's they don't care about whether or not you think whether or not you're in or you're out. You're in insofar as you're there. If you show up and you're willing to participate, you're in, right? And you're not out just because you don't show up the next Sunday, right, or whatever. Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. So disagreement with the pastor, who cares?
Great.
So,
awesome.
Big deal, right? that's fine. And that's because they have this underlying basis that says we are not determined by whoever's in leadership, whoever shows up on Sunday morning. That's not who defines us. That can change day in, day out. What matters is there's a substance, a tradition, a practice that we are going to participate in together, and that's who we are. So it just changes your dynamic and how you think about yourself and the community.
I just see, like, in a lot of Christian history, when Christianity actually dominates the culture and has power, that you end up seeing as it takes over culture, there's like a shift from what it was trying to do to change that culture into actually just perpetuating whatever, wherever they're at that time. And I don't.
Yeah.
And the good thing about secularism of our country is that we get this non-dominant Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of Trump getting, I love politics, so I love the idea of what's happened with when we got Obama. Obviously, I like the idea of Obama more than Trump. But the cycle that happens when you within politics is similar too. You have this,
yeah,
it's very reactionary.
It's reactionary, and
absolutely,
Obama was a reactionary to a long, kind of this long Republican rule.
Right.
And it was great, and it had all of this change within our society, but it came so fast. You have the other reaction going, I don't agree with any of this. Trump's not a surprise if you see it. It's a surprise that he got through the Republican Party, but now that I hear more about, or I'm sorry, the Republican primary, but now that I hear more about the how, because I didn't know that about evangelical, how evangelical really can grab anything societal. It makes sense that they would just grab onto whoever was perpetuating what they wanted at the time.
Right, exactly.
And it's him. He says, everything I've heard from every fundamentalist Christian I've ever talked to, right down the line, right down the line.
Yep.
Everything. He's
all
saying it
points.
All.
Yeah.
And he's doing it all.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the history of reactionary politics. I mean, there's, you know Malcolm Gladwell. He has a podcast, which I recommend, called Revisionist History. And one of the episodes of that podcast looks at the way in which you can pretty much determine the political winner of an election based on the reaction to the previous winner. And there's a famous situation in Australia where the prime minister, they had the first female prime minister, you know, just a few years ago there in Australia. And the next election, they elected the person who was the most sexist against her during the previous cycle, right? It was the fullest reaction to her, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have, I mean, these things are not unique to the U.S. It's a pervasive human problem of swinging from one side to the other.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the danger also of when you get into power of then becoming part of that machine and not holding your ideals. And we see this repeatedly with presidents who make promises and then do something very, very different. But that happens in Christianity too, you know, in terms of reform movements that then become stabilized and retain certain power, and then they lose sight of their mission, right? You know, a church plant that starts out small and feisty, and then grows and large and becomes part of the patriarchal order. You know, that's happens again and again and again. So. Yeah.
I was watching a documentary last night. Just for me, I'm so sorry. It was on Kenner Toys that signed the contract with Star Wars, the first Star Wars movie. And when they were this tiny toy company in Cincinnati, they could make different choices because of their size, and they didn't have much to lose. But if you didn't know, Star Wars has made $7 billion with the movie worldwide. The toys have made $14 billion.
Wow.
So it became this monster company.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You can be as cynical as you want about that process, but making a decision that impacts 50 employees is very different than making a decision that impacts 5,000 employees or 50,000 employees. And when things scale to certain sizes, you make different decisions because of institutional responsibility.
Yeah.
And decisions get made slower. And so that's why I'm really curious if our answer isn't the rise of the megachurch created as many problems because megachurches have to make megachurch decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a scale issue that we can't be intentional about? Because you can make different decisions when you don't have.
There's a church in New York City that does this, actually. They require that once you reach 100 members, you have to plant a new church. It's part of their, so they have like 15 different locations around New York, the different boroughs.
Which church?
I forgot the name of it now. You can probably look it up. But yeah, but they're, that's the whole thing, is that they want to avoid the temptation to have economic power and stability. Yeah, and that's certainly, I mean, that's, yeah, I mean, that's a very real problem for all churches. Yeah.
And also in that model, think of how much new and diverse leadership you can raise up. When you don't have one pulpit, you have 15 pulpits operating on a Sunday morning, and it's not a satellite campus.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's crucial too, yeah, right.
And then you have leaders who are, you know, familiar with those specific communities, you know, and it does make it, makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the things that's really interesting about most mainline denominations is, you know, there's tons of that type of church all over the place. And for the most part, people stay really close to where they live because they want to be intentional about where they are physically located, that they're a part of work in their own community. So it's very interesting in evangelicalism where you have, I mean, mostly it is like the charisma of whoever's the leader in whatever church, you know, you're willing to drive X amount of minutes or miles to attend that particular church for that particular person, instead of being really intentional about, I mean, you can, obviously you can do things in your own community in different ways, but then the church is kind of splintered off in all these different areas.
There's a historical,
geographically.
And there's a historical reason for this, and that is because the mainline churches are descended directly from the European Reformation movements. In Europe, they have the parish model of church, where every town has a church in their city center, and that's their local parish. And you just go to that parish. You don't choose the church you go to. You're assigned a church based on where you're born, basically, right? And that parish model migrated to the U.S. in the mainline churches. And the evangelical churches, which were revivalist communities, were in opposition to that. So rather than being located wherever your local parish is, you're defined by, you know, the large gathering. You go to where wherever the revivalist preacher goes. So you go to hear the Billy Graham or the George Whitfield or whoever it might be, and that's your church community. And you might drive hours to go there, or drive, you know, take a horse and carriage, whatever, you know, wherever it might be in history. But you go to that person because that's who you wanted to hear. So there wasn't a local parish community. It was the revival you go to.
Or now I'd always move across the country to go to a specific church, right?
Right, yeah, exactly. So.
Well, the fact that evangelical churches, too, just they, you know, it's so, it's just based on whatever you want to create a church. So, I mean, I believe really strongly, I mean, John and I would rather be in a church in our neighborhood right here, but there isn't a church I want to go to, because if I want to stay within the evangelical tradition, they're all so different, but none of them match my values and the way I want to do church. You know?
Yeah.
So it creates a problem. Evangelicals, yep. In that sense of how it's formed and the kind of churches you have, it creates a problem of being local.
Yeah, I mean, there's, a book I'd also recommend if you want to think about alternative versions of church is called, the book is called The Church Inside Out. It's an old book from the 60s or 70s by a man named Johannes Christian Hockendyke. It's a very, very, I mean, way ahead of its time kind of book. I mean, I use it a lot in my own work. It's brilliant. But part of his effort, and he was very involved in the ecumenical, you know, church movements and, you know, early mission movement stuff, was thinking about, you know, how do we form new kinds of localities? He even proposed the idea of like having a church centered around local phone booths, you know, where, you know, that'd be like a beacon point where, you know, communities would show up or gather around various, like a phone booth, you know, and that would be the local point, you know. So he's trying to think, like, what unites local communities, you know? What's the center point now? If we don't have a parish like we in the Europe, what do we do, you know? And anyway, he was just trying to think of something, you know, and being willing to innovate in really interesting ways. Another really interesting person is Dorothy Zerle. It's a German S-O-E-L-L-E. She was a professor of theology at Union Seminary in New York City. But when she was in Germany, during the Vietnam era, She developed what they called night prayer meetings, where that was basically her church, was a group of people would meet in her home at night, one night of the week. And part of what they do is they would have their own kind of little simplified liturgy of prayer, but then they would look at the newspaper of the day and look at the problems in their local community and talk about how to engage those issues, whether it was like, you know, political protest movement, or whether it was, you know, working on a, you know, an election or something like that, whatever it might be, you know, whatever needed to be addressed, you know. And so you'd always read the paper as part of your local meeting and gathering, as part of church. That was part of the liturgy. Yeah.
Which feels like in opposition of a lot of what the evangelical church today does.
Oh, sure. Like, right. Ignoring the right. Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. There's that problem.
Right, that they should be separate.
Right. And that's the spiritualization of the church doctrine that I mentioned before, right? Yeah, that once you spiritualize Christianity as being non-social and non-political, then, yeah, those things become irrelevant, right? We're just waiting for the end of the world.
So in that, this is actually a conversation Harriet and I were having, is, like, so some of the language we use is that cascade, like, the gospel will always be political because it is. But right now our political system is fixed within a partisan binary. So anytime you're having a political conversation, people are assuming, they're sliding into one of two categories.
Right, yeah.
So how do you have political conversations that aren't assumed to be, because our political system is a binary. It's your Republican or Democrat. And people would say, like, well, a vote for you know, Trump would vote for Hillary. Or vote for you. Why would you throw away your vote? Was a common refrain in our last election. Yeah. So I'm just interested in, like, how do you have some of those non-evangelical reactionary things when it's not just a religious binary? There's a political binary that's kind of dominating.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is partly why, you know, the church needs to recover its prophetic, you know, traditions. I mean, part of the prophetic legacy, both in the Hebrew scriptures, but also in, like, the state civil rights movement, is this challenge to the social order as such and not simply to a political party. I mean, part of what I appreciate about somebody like Cornel West, for example, is that, you know, he's as vocal against the Democrats as he is with the Republicans. I mean, it's an equal opportunity offender for him, you know, and because the whole order needs to be, you know, reshaped and be subjected to critique and reform. I think there's something really important about that. A lot of my friends and fellow activists are neither Republican or Democrat. You know, some of them are Democratic socialists, some of them are full-on communists, some are whatever, or just independents, you know? And they're just, you know, all over the spectrum, but they're not, but it certainly is, what's important is not tying any of those party affiliations with message of the gospel itself, but ensuring that, recognizing that the gospel is a subversion of the whole order constantly. It's a constant subversion. There's a line, forgot who originated it now. Professor Paul Lehmann made it more popular, but it goes back to Marx, I think, actually. But the idea of a permanent revolution, and Paul Lehmann took this into theology, is like, theology is a permanent revolution. You know, there's no, you can't stay static at any point. We can't say now we've arrived. You know, now we have the perfect social order or perfect political, you know, alliance. There's a permanent revolution that's intrinsic to the Christianity, and that's I would call that the prophetic tradition, you know, largely. But yeah, I think that's one way is recovering that mentality and that, so, you know, preaching that way or teaching that way, just reminding people that. We're in constant motion.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I would imagine that the larger challenge would be constant motion towards what?
Yeah, right. There's a yes. And the prophetic tradition, right? And the prophetic tradition has a very strong, you know, message, right? It has a very clear norm, right? Norm of justice for the oppressed, and, you know, for the orphans and the widows, you know, all that stuff in the prophetic tradition that's there, you know. It's not, you know, sacrifices mean nothing, but rather care for the hungry, and you know, so there's a substance there. There's a kind of an ideal or a norm that they're working towards. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. But the language helps to kind of evoke some of that. Kingdom of God language is tricky. because it gets co-opted very easily by everybody. You know, I mean, it's one of those terms that is almost like evangelical nowadays. You know, anyone can claim it, and you know what you mean by the kingdom of God is very ambiguous. You have to really do a lot of work ahead of time to clarify what that means. So yeah, that's a long conversation, but yes. Yeah.
Kind of like what it used to mean to say the good news.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Well, good news is just a translation of gospel, right? That's just what it means. Yeah. Yeah.
You've been talking about evangelical. Have you largely been referring to like non-denominational churches there? Is that kind of what you're talking about?
So, yes, I think largely. So the denominational
evangelical. She didn't hear your original definition that you.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah. I can refer to it. I mean, evangelical, as I was defining it in what I said earlier, was basically those churches that descend from what was called Pietism in Europe. This kind of which was a reform movement there to make Christianity more heartfelt and spiritual. As it came to the U.S. and took hold in the revival movements in this country. So revivalism in the Great Awakenings in this country, which is where evangelicalism, as I use it, I use that term to refer to an American version of Pietism that took hold in the revivals in this country. And those revivals shaped it in very particular ways. It made it very individualistic, made it very, there were good things about it. They were very socially active. So they tied evangelism to social activism against like abolitionism. But it was kind of a constantly purifying mode. You're always purifying whatever is the old order and making something better or newer, more faithful, more evangelical, more Christian. And that purifying impulse, as it continued throughout history, eventually, you know, was able to be turned in very conservative reactionary directions pretty easily, because there wasn't something substance there. It was always revival, always reform, you know, constantly making itself more pure. So
when you say you want evangelicals to die, but at the same time,
yeah,
what you want to do is purify it, so you're actually engaging in evangelical
practice. I want the American evangelicals, as we've encountered in this country, to die, but the reform shouldn't die. I mean, insofar as so the version of evangelicalism that needs to die is this negative, constantly reacting, formal, purifying mode, where it's just reacting to something previous that it needs to make more pure, more faithful. Rather, I think we need to reform in a very different sense. That is, clarifying, identifying the substance of our faith and shaping our belief and practice around that. And so moving away from this kind of individualistic reactionary posture to something that's more communal, socially engaged, and rooted in something positive. You know, there's a vision for what we need to be moving towards. So
is it possible to reframe that whole apocalyptic end times theology to current evangelicals? I mean, are they buying a new story or?
So are you asking? Is there a way to like save that apocalyptic eschatology, or are you asking it?
Yeah. And is there a way to reverse that?
Yeah, oh, I see, right. So, yeah, the question is, can we reverse the apocalyptic eschatology? I think it's interesting that in my encounters with evangelicals more recently, there are far fewer evangelicals who are interested in some of that old apocalyptic eschatology. A lot of that stuff... It was really strong up until like the 90s, 80s and 90s. You know, we left behind all that stuff, right? But it's really taken a down. Like, it's not nearly as attractive to the younger evangelicals for a number of reasons. One being just the world's apocalyptic, right? I mean, we don't need to believe in an apocalyptic future coming where it's like our system, our structures are apocalyptic, you know, on a daily basis. I've been working on a piece about kind of the apocalyptic nature of our world today. And New York Times had a essay review of some a few years ago on all these apocalyptic movies coming out, you know, and just what it says about our culture and society. We just, you know, whether it's Walking Dead or whatever it might be, but just the sense that, you know, the end is nigh, right? And and you know, there's a massive burgeoning movement of these like survivalist kits, you know. Like these stores around the country are selling out of these, you know, survival kits to prepare for the coming zombie apocalypse, right? And that, I think it's just pervasive. And so, yeah, I mean, the old apocalyptic eschatology just it really fed off of a culture that believed in stability, that things were, it was a reaction to the sense that the world is whole and just, everything's going right. And
there was no need to be saved from anything at that point in time, so we needed to create something.
Yeah, so the evangelicals were reacting against that. So the post-Civil War period, when this whole thing began, was a very, that was like the early prosperous movement. You get into the Gilded Age from all that, where things, money and power, America looks great, we finally are unified, and then there's all this, there's just this optimism in that period, and these evangelicals are like, pessimism, actually, God is going to save us all from this corrupt, wealth and everything. And we need to, actually, we're all going to be, purged in the coming fires of the apocalypse. But yeah, and I think, and then that all got fed by all the politics and the wars and everything in this 20th century where it seemed to be real, the communist order is here, and now we've got, all the stuff fed into that, the sense of fear that, and Israel became a lot of, big part of that too, and all those issues. So, I mean, I think nowadays that's no longer as a much interest, but it's not gone away. It's just migrated. It's become this kind of social cultural apocalypticism. So that's why, I mean, I think the old apocalyptic views of the evangelicals and fundamentalists from the late 19th, early 20th centuries, that was the sense that the world and social order is all going downhill and we need to rescue ourselves from the coming end. And nowadays the evangelicals are like, well, the social order is going downhill, but we need it, but now it's not, there's a coming end of, the second coming is in our imminent future, but rather we need to build a cultural fortress to protect ourselves from this corrupt society. So the culture war basically is the new version of this apocalyptic eschatology. It's not that there's going to be this tribulation period in the imminent future. We're in the tribulation because the global war on Christians is happening right now, mm-hmm. right? That's how it's morphed, is that it's not this coming tribulation, but that actually rather we're being attacked right now by godless society and secularism and all the rest. And so we need to fight to preserve our Christian culture at any cost. So that's how the apocalyptic eschatology has kind of manifested itself. But it's no longer couched in the old terms of the coming end of the world in that sense. It's couched in terms of, our old way of life is coming to an end, And so that culture is under threat. But interestingly, whereas the older evangelicals thought, okay, we're going to be rescued, the newer evangelicals are like, we need to rescue ourselves. That's a different posture. There's less optimism or hope that Jesus is going to come back, in my lifetime and save me from this doom. Now it's, that idea has gone away. Very few people believe that anymore. Yeah, there are some people, but not very many. It's fewer and fewer. It seems like increasingly fewer. Rather, it's more, we need to build a separate society, like the Benedict Option. So I don't know if you know about that book, but the Benedict Option was a very New York Times bestseller last year by a guy who believes that Christians need to create a new monastic order, basically, to kind of preserve Christians' culture and society in the face of the you know, the godless secular world that we're in nowadays. And so we need to retreat. Basically, it's a retreating movement to protect our way of life. So that's a much more widespread view nowadays. So it's apocalyptic in a different sense. Yeah. But it's not apocalyptic that God is bringing on. It's apocalyptic that, sinful humans are bringing on.
Over and over.
Right.
Yeah. One thing I was glad that got brought up, was non-denominationalism and specifically what you said about mainline Christianity and how now even atheists are kind of welcomed into the group. I've been to a non-denominational church, and several times they talked about things like divine intervention in regards to your money. If you believe in Jesus, you'll get good deals on eBay. Like, it was just, it was stuff that I was like really shocked that people were talking about, because as an atheist agnostic, I was like, this stuff doesn't matter. Like, why are you wasting your time here? And I feel like lots of atheists are feeling that way about all religion. And I don't think that's a fair representation of a lot of liberal churches. What kind of effective activism is appropriate for mainline Christianity or liberal churches? And how do we welcome more atheist voices to kind of critique the things we're talking about and whether or not they actually matter in today's world?
Yeah.
So, like, specifically, is there anything that as a group that a church can do towards activism? Or is it more of a, like, what you're talking about in the church that matters?
So by activism, you mean trying to spread the news that the atheist agnostics are welcome. That's what you're, that's interesting. I mean, it's funny, like the churches we've been in just kind of take it for granted. It's like, oh yeah, you're welcome regardless of what you believe. I don't know. Do you want to speak to this at all?
You want to tell them why you were fired?
Oh, sure. I mean, I was fired because I'm a universalist. You know, I don't believe anyone's going to hell. I don't believe there's a hell. But so, yeah, that was a problem for my evangelical employers.
So when we told people at our at our church at the time that that was why he was fired, most of them just kind of looked at us like, what? Like,
oh, that's a thing? Nobody in our church understood why that was a pop. I mean, they all don't. None of them believe in hell.
That was like a majority thing that people were generally not believing in hell anymore.
I mean, it's a...
I mean, mainline churches, that's pretty common. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on where you are.
we in Oregon, there's definitely, you're gonna see that pervasive. You move.
I'm in a bubble of mountains.
South. You move south and even into parts of and all through flyover country or not.
Changes.
This is a unique place.
Very much so. Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
one of the things that's interesting is, although this is a unique place, if you zoom out big scale, Portland, Oregon, church culture in Portland is not liberal.
In fact, it's
extremely reactionary. And every time we tell people we're from Portland, they just they make assumptions about what, you know, the kind of church background that we came from and stuff. And we always have to clarify, no, you don't understand. Yes, Portland is a very liberal city, but because of that, most of the churches tend to be extremely conservative. And they just that kind of blows their minds.
When we first moved over to we moved over to Princeton and joined an evangelical church out there, and they were like, what's the problem with women in ministry? Like, that wasn't like they didn't understand what that was an issue, you know. It just wasn't on the radar, you know. Like, oh, this is a very very different situation. So there's so much of it is about reaction to the surrounding environment. But anyway, back to the original point. I think it's a good question. One of the things I like about the mainline churches, what they do in terms of activism, is they partner with other churches and also other non-religious groups. a lot.
Or other religious
groups. Or other religious groups, right, yeah.
Other religions.
When we were in Chicago, we were at our Episcopal church there. We were part of a group called DuPage United, which is a community organizing group, which partnered with, you know, Buddhists and Jews and Muslims and, you know, all
labor unions.
Labor unions, right, yeah. Whatever it might be. And to work together, you know, whatever needed we should do. And we would talk about the needs of our neighborhood. And it was just assumed that we should work together, that we should partner and take care of each other, you know, and that didn't matter what you believed or anything. And some of them would come to our church, you know, there would be, I personally led an adult education seminar on interfaith dialogue at our church over the course of several weeks. And we brought in, you know, a Jewish speaker and a Muslim speaker and Buddhist and who else? Is that it?
I was there.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was great. And just having a conversation with the people in the church, in the community, where most of the church would show up for it. And we have a nice big conversation and, you know, there was never any concern like, ooh, are you saved or not? That was never on the table. It was all about
that language isn't used.
Yeah, they just don't. That language is completely foreign to them. Yeah,
because it's not threatening, and it's like, you know, I grew up with like, if you don't believe this and we hold the right way, then I disagree with them. But you don't even know what you're disagreeing with.
Right. That was the reason why I did. That's the point of why I did the whole series of talks. It was just education, understanding our neighbors.
Because it's not like, oh, you find out about this and then, oh, what if you believe? Like, that's right. Really scary and don't have your kids here.
Yeah. And if we had been there longer, I had planned a second series on our Christian neighbors, different denominations were going to come and speak. Because, you know, if you've been a lifelong Episcopalian, you probably don't know anything about what a Baptist believes or what a Methodist believes, you know. You might know a little bit. You know, we partnered with our Lutheran church for a homeless ministry that we did, but, you know, we didn't really talk to them about their theology or their practices, you know. So,
but it takes that authority out, like, we're the right way and we're the only way.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So giving
and wonderful. And so, one of the things I didn't...
with us.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. Exactly. I mean, so, something I didn't talk about, which I should bring up, is... one of the core differences between mainline and evangelical in this country is that the mainline churches, beginning in the mid or early mid 20th century, became joined together to become part of what they call the ecumenical movement. The ecumenical movement was developed in the post-war period with the sense that we need to work together globally. So the World Council of Churches was formed early 20th century to do this, and the mainline churches were the ones. You can define a mainline church based on who participated in the World Council of Churches,
okay.
Because that's basically what it comes down to. And the evangelicals rejected that; they rejected participation in the World Council of Churches because those people weren't true Christians, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't authentic Christians. They didn't have the right beliefs, or they had too loose doctrine, or they didn't believe in biblical inerrancy. Like, those things just weren't part of it. And so basically the divide between evangelicals and mainline is the sense of, do we partner with others? And that's what that's meant, like, in terms of our history of evangelicalism, is that evangelicals are very insular and very kind of closed off from others. They tend to be, we support our own, we have our own subculture. We have our own networks that we connect to, and we're fearful of the church down the street, or they're fearful of partnering with somebody who, you know, may not fully agree with them. You know, we don't. right.
Which is why it works so well in American culture.
Yeah.
It feeds into the same rugged individualism that, you know.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this is that mainline churches, because they have this strong sense of partnering with others, they're also less concerned about protecting themselves, which means that's why, you know, you'll hear these stories about the mainline churches are dying, you know, and the evangelical churches, they're the ones that are still thriving. Well, that's true partly, but a big reason for why that's true is because mainline churches don't care about self-preservation. They don't view that as being their primary virtue and value. What's more concerning for them is, are we doing the work of the church? Are we partnering with our neighbors? And they'll spend money that will go to other groups, you know, the local nonprofit, or their money might go towards another church down the road, you know, because their resources are being shared, right, among other groups, and they aren't concerned about making sure they stay within the ecosystem of their own church network. I mean, that's not always true, but it's large. That's more often true than not. Whereas evangelicals, especially like Baptists, like I talked about before, the Southern Baptist ecosystem is totally self-enclosed. Doesn't want any interaction with anyone else, and that's a threat, you know, to them. So that
are our mainline churches socialist then?
A lot of them are probably, yeah. Some of them are. I'll subscribe to that, but I mean, but yeah, I mean, there is definitely a different sense of about how they view money and resources. It's not about making sure we have more, but are we distributing it in a just way? Yeah. And that's largely because of the ecumenical movement and what that fostered in those churches. So it's just a different DNA. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, because of time, I wanted to right at it. I wanted to give people the freedom if you needed to go or all that. And so we move this from maybe formal to more informal, right? Harriet's not kicking
you can stay
out.
As long as you want.
So as long as all you right. want, but you don't have to stay. Like, so if you're like, oh, I don't want to get up, I'd be interrupting.
I won't be hurt if you leave, so that's okay. But thank you.